Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Just Interesting podcast, the podcast that has been described by critics as technically a podcast and not as long as some other podcasts.
Do you like that? Oh my gosh. That was brilliant. Okay, that was fantastic.
Today, we're going to be discussing one of the most audacious prison breaks in history. The real life story that inspired the movie Escape from Alcatraz.
With Clint Eastwood.
Have you seen the film, Robin? What do you think?
1979. I own it on DVD.
I own it. Yes. Do you notice how I asked if you'd seen it first and then immediately asked what you thought of it? Because I realized that's a stupid question. You've definitely seen it. And along with all
that's
other
not
films.
Guaranteed. That's not guaranteed, but
it's,
yes,
it's
I am
never not
a film
been the
fan.
Case.
No, yeah. Have you seen it?
I have, yeah. Yeah. I
believe it's on Netflix, right?
I think I don't know for sure. Other streaming services are available. I don't know. I think I watched it the last time we discussed this topic as a kind of research.
You know? Ah, yeah.
It's a great film. And it's a good comprehensive overview of the story itself, I think. It's remarkable how close the story doesn't really need to be adapted that much for cinema, because it is an amazing story just on its own.
It's such a perfect prison break story. And I think also with that film, it takes a few other incidents from Alcatraz history, because obviously it has quite a long history, and kind of gives those incidents to the characters in the film. So even though the film is fictional in many respects, it's everything that happens in the film is something that happened in real life, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. They move things around ever so slightly.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's most for the most part what happened. As someone in the comments has noted, AM says, "Oh no, where's Martin?" And people may be dismayed to hear that Martin is no longer with us. He is in prison again, Robin.
Yet again.
He broke his parole. AM says streaking again, is he? And you're absolutely spot on. He broke his parole.
Well, it's more than that, isn't it? Because you mentioned last time we did a two-person podcast, we were discussing American politics, and we mentioned how Martin had got in trouble because, you know, he's taken a real swing to one side of the political spectrum, and he's gone. He's gone to the red states, hasn't he?
Yeah. I flew out in the last few days because I was visiting him. I was his emergency contact, and I flew out there and I said, "Martin, what are you doing? Robin, you should see the man. He's joined a prison gang.
He
took off his shirt unprompted. He's got tattoos everywhere, all over his chest of the prison itself. And he wanted me to slip him something under the table. He wants to do a prison break. And he said, Alex, can you discuss on the podcast the best way to break out of prison in order to help him escape? So I thought I'd do that today. I'd do an interesting story about a prison escape, and hopefully that can inspire Martin to do a prison break of him for himself.
Yeah, so Martin, if you're listening, this one's for you.
This one's for you, Martin. But as it may become clear to anyone listening to this at a later date, this is a live podcast. So if you're listening to this on platforms like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, we host these live on YouTube every Monday today it's 9:30 p.m. BST, but usually it's at 9 p.m. or 3 p.m. EST for our friends across the pond. You could be as cool as some of the people in the chat right now, like Bushlight, Ethan Walker, Recu97, C.S. Drummerson. We've got the usual crowd in tonight, and it's great to have you all with us this evening. Thank you for tuning in. Follow us on YouTube, Just Interesting, and subscribe, and make sure you don't miss us live on Mondays at 9 p.m. And you can join the discussion with us. But Robin, before we get into the mystery surrounding Alcatraz, of course, we've got to discuss some interesting facts that we've learned this week. Have you found anything interesting this week you'd like to talk to us about?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Alex, because Hidden History with Ray in the chat did just ask, what did you learn this week? And this week, well, how do you feel about time travel, Alex? Well, are you a time travel fan?
Oh, if I could go back several years, Robin, I'd do it all again. I'd make some changes. No, sorry, that took a dark turn, didn't it? No, I don't know what you want me to say about that question. I like time travel as a concept. That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, yes, I know you're a big time travel fan, and so am I. And I thought, I was just interested the other day, and I was thinking, oh, hang on a second, what was the first time travel story? So I looked it up, and apparently,
well, H.G. Wells. Debated. Was it H.G. Wells?
No. No, okay. Okay. It was not H.G. Wells, but it depends how you define it. There is some kind of conflict, apparently, some debate between scholars about what constitutes the first time travel story, and I'll explain a bit more in a minute. But the oldest recorded story that contains an element of time travel is apparently from China, from the year 1640.
Ooh. Okay.
And it's a kind of sequel/spin-off called A Supplement to the Journey to the West. So Journey to the West is the main story, a famous legend. You heard of the Monkey King?
It rings a bell. That does ring a bell.
Yeah, popular icon, big legendary, well, lots of what we would, to Europeans, medieval stories. To the Chinese, I think they're from the, I want to say Qing dynasty?
Yeah.
Possibly before. And
that's okay. We don't fact check on this podcast often. You can say whatever you want with utmost assurance. That's fine.
Several popular TV series have been made based on the Monkey King legend. Anyway, this kind of supplement to the Journey to the West, which is about the Monkey King, follows the adventure of the Monkey King, who is trapped in a dream world by the Qing fish demon, which is an embodiment of desire, who traps the Monkey King by putting him in this tower, this dream tower, and it's full of mirrors, and by walking through the mirrors, the Monkey King can go to different points in time. And he goes to the past and gets an artifact and then goes through another mirror into the future and kind of does lots of fetch quests and things like that.
Fetch quests? This sounds like it should be turned into a game.
It sounds perfect for a game, doesn't it? Yeah. I'm being a bit reductive. And I'm insulting anyone who's read it and is a big fan of the culture.
A bunch of people just sighed massively about you describing it as fetch quests.
Yeah, I just insulted an entire fan base and continent. So that's apparently the earliest time travel story. But there is a wrinkle in time, you might say.
Yeah.
Which is that because it's a dream in this story, it's explicitly a dream. The demon has kind of cast a spell and the Monkey King is dreaming that he can travel through time. And the whole point is that he has to wake himself up to get out of the dream so he can defeat the demon. A lot of people say that doesn't count as time travel because it's just a dream. And so the first time travel story, some people say, is closer to H.G. Wells's time. Mm. And in fact, our good friend Charles Dickens has a claim.
Oh, really?
To one of the earliest time travel stories with, yeah.
A Christmas Carol.
A Christmas Carol, yeah.
Wow.
Because in that, Ebenezer Scrooge travels to his own past and witnesses the past. He can't change it, but he witnesses it. What he can do is he also travels to the future, of course, and spoiler alert for anyone who doesn't know the story, he sees a future for himself and changes it at the end of the story. So that's, it's not the first, but it's a top contender for the first time travel story in terms of kind of pure sci-fi style time travel. You can change things. You can influence the course of events kind of thing.
Do you know what? I'm really surprised about that. Like, even when you said the story from China from the 16th century, did you say?
1640, yes. 17th century, sorry.
Yeah. I'm really surprised about that because I feel like that doesn't need to be... That's quite a universal thing, isn't it? To look back on your life and think, I wish I'd done that differently. So I'm surprised conceptually that didn't... There isn't an older example of that.
The idea of traveling time. And I wonder if that's a really good example of historians and archaeologists sociologists are always trying to impress upon people the importance of material culture isn't the only thing that changes. Mm. It's perceptions of the world, you know. So it's not just that in, say, medieval Britain, you go back 500 years, people were way more religious than they are now.
Right, yeah, that's true.
People were way more superstitious. But one thing that they might have had, I think this suggests, this discovery about time travel stories not really being a thing until the last 3 centuries or 4 centuries, is that people's concept of time must have been very linear, very much past is the past, can't change it.
Yeah. And also, and if everyone
why bother about the future? We're all going to die and go to heaven, so what's the point?
I mean, maybe if everyone's idea of the afterlife was very much set in stone and that was kind of the belief of the time, then there's no point looking back at the past because, yeah, you've got that to look forward to or be utterly terrified of if you're worried about going to hell, I guess. that's really, really interesting.
Thank you, yeah. What did you learn this week, Alex?
I will tell you what I learned this week, Robin. But first, I've made a huge classic blunder of season 4 or season 5 of the podcast, whichever you decide.
Where are we? But we don't know.
As Ethan Walker points out, any riddle this week? And I've totally forgotten to tell you the riddle this week because there is a riddle this week.
The riddle of time.
And I've noticed this season, Robin, you've started to get annoyed at the riddles that are very much like miss out a key piece of information.
The riddles that sound like puzzles and have no information. And you're just like, the answer could be anything.
So
it could literally be a tomato.
I'm making it my mission to find riddles like this just to annoy you. So I've got one. Here's one for you, Robin.
Okay,
here's the riddle of the week. If 11 plus 2 equals 1, what does 9 plus 5 equal?
What?
I'll say it again. If 11 plus 2 equals 1, what does 9 plus 5 equal? And if you get it in the comments, then feel free to write it. Or, you know, you can save your answer and I'll read this and go through it again later on and give you the answer.
11 plus 2 equals 1.
If 11 plus 2 equals 1, then what does 9 plus 5 equal?
What? That's not a riddle.
It is. It's a riddle.
It's not a riddle. What is that? That's nonsense.
well, ponder that, Robin. Ponder that. And let's move on. But I'll tell you what I learned this week. So what is your favorite item on a Christmas dinner?
Oh, roast potatoes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is the correct answer. So well done. But for
thank you.
But if you'd said Brussels sprouts, I would have judged you heavily.
No, not a sprout man. No.
And anyone
I'm
in
glad.
The okay, good. Well, we can agree on this. Brussels sprouts are not good. But it may interest you to know that they're actually better than they've ever been, and it's thanks to a Dutch research group in the 90s. So
yes.
Before the 90s, Brussels sprouts were way worse, way more bitter. But in,
really?
Yeah, they were different.
They were worse than they are now.
They used to have an even more bitter taste until breeders in the 90s started to cross-pollinate different varieties in order to remove the chemicals that caused the bitterness. And this is why Brussels sprouts have kind of become way more popular in like culinary things. I've noticed them pop up a lot more in cookbooks and been on.
Yes,
you know,
they seem more readily available in the shops too, actually.
Yeah. So this was all thanks to a Dutch scientist named Hans van Doorn, which is the most Dutch name I could possibly imagine.
It's pretty Hans, pretty Dutch, yeah.
he worked at a seed and chemical company called Novartis, and they figured out exactly which chemical compounds in Brussels sprouts made them bitter. And then they joined forces with a couple of other companies that sell Brussels sprout seeds and started pouring through the archives, looking for different varieties of Brussels sprouts, and eventually cross-pollinated the ones with the least bitter chemicals.
Yeah.
This is what's kind of largely increased the popularity of Brussels sprouts today. So thanks, I guess. I mean, it's good that they are less bad than they once were, but come on, just give up. Just give up with them.
I know,
they're still not
like,
good.
It's no, it's interesting because my wife is a big fan of Brussels sprouts. And so last year, I think, she made some for Christmas and, you know, dutifully, I was like, oh, okay, I'll try one. It's been years since I had one. And it was better than I remembered. And that might be why. Because it's been improved in the decade since I last ate one. But But I'm sorry, I need to, I'm just going to hammer it home. I'm going to elaborate pointlessly on the on what you just said, Alex, because... So, selective breeding in animals, right? Humans have done it for a long time.
Sure.
And they've done it for obvious reasons, which is, hey, how can we... Everyone likes the meat. Everyone needs the meat. Let's breed an animal that is bigger and gives us more meat. And hey, if at the same time the meat is got more muscle and less fat, that's also good because more meat to go around. This is good selective breeding. But when you get to the point, Alex, where you're using 21st century technology and industrial systems to make a Brussels sprout less terrible, I agree with you entirely. Yeah. Give up. Take that sprout and cast it out into the wilderness where it shall not grow. Throw it into the ocean and let it take over the seafloor. Let the algae and the lobsters and the crabs demolish the thing and eradicate its existence from the world. Well, it's not my least favorite thing, but there's a horror story from Brussels sprouts. I think it's one of the reasons I didn't like them as a child. I didn't like them mainly because they taste horrible, but
yeah,
my dad loved them, except he told me a horror story that one Christmas when he was young, they got... They're a poor family, so they used to go to the farmer's field and pick the Brussels sprouts.
Right.
And they got them in one Christmas.
I have a feeling this is going to be particularly bad.
His mum cooked them all, served them all up, and dad, you know, just started eating them. You know, crunch, crunch, crunch. And then his mum said, don't eat them all at once. You know, cut them up and eat them. So dad was like, oh, fine. So he cut one open, and it was hollow. And inside were flies.
Oh, no.
Cooked flies. And he cut open all the others, and all his brothers did the same. And the whole crop had been infested with... Clearly, maggots had been inside, and they'd grown into flies, and then they'd been cooked. And my dad had eaten two or three of them before he'd cut them open.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, yeah. So, yet another reason. Yet another reason.
That is... absolutely horrendous, Robin. But look, I have to disagree with you on principle, because yes, I agree. Like, it might seem crazy to use 21st tech to just make Brussels sprouts slightly less awful, but that's just a stepping stone, isn't it? Then they could make them taste like... hopefully down the line they can make them taste amazing. Imagine if they made it taste like roast potatoes. Just then it's like more roast potatoes on the plate. That'd be great. And
yeah, but I'd rather have just, you know, roast potatoes. Yeah.
But this kind of technology has, I think tomatoes is the obvious example. Like, originally tomatoes were like tiny, tiny little things, and they've massively increased the size and the yield of tomatoes thanks to like technology like this. And that's kind of helping, that kind of principle is helping feed way more people across the world.
I'm 100% in favor of the application of technology and selective breeding to get the most out of our crops. I just, when it comes, when you put, point made. I shall cease the ranting.
You're like, do I want to die on this hill? I understand technology helping improve the lives of millions, but also Brussels sprouts still taste bad.
Exactly. Oh dear.
I just wanted to shout out Ryan Thurston in the comments. Says, my first time catching this live. Used to watch these videos in the old days. Been listening to the podcast, and you guys are doing amazing. Keep up the good work. Just thought that was lovely.
Thank you, Ryan. Thanks, Ryan. Yeah, that's cheers. Amazing. Thank you.
But there you go. There's a little factoid about everyone's least favorite part of Christmas dinner, the Brussels sprouts. But let us know in the comments what you think of Brussels sprouts, if you like them, if they have a place at your table. Do you know what annoys me, actually? When chefs are like, oh, people just don't cook them right. And then they cook them by like chopping them up and frying them in fat and oil and bacon and with like a massive amount of seasoning. And they're like, now it tastes good. Yeah, no surprise. No thanks to the Brussels sprouts. Like, they're still awful. We've just masked their flavor in a bunch of nice things.
That's the thing, you know. It doesn't enhance the flavor of Brussels sprouts, it disguises the flavor. Yes. What are you doing?
Yes.
Ewan Lang in the chat says, can't beat a homegrown tomato. I agree.
Do you grow your own tomatoes, Robin?
Well, yeah, we until recently, obviously it's winter now, but yeah, I've got two tomato plants.
Hey. Oh, good for you.
You just said they yield more, and they do. They go nuts, man.
Yeah, no, they do. Tomatoes. Yeah.
It's fantastic, yeah. Started it during lockdown, you know. One of those classic, we're at home all the time, let's grow some plants, let's grow something that gives us food.
we did as well actually, we planted tomatoes, yeah. But they died very quickly. We do not have a green thumb. We were like, oh no, the plant is dry, if only there was something that we could do about this. why does this keep happening?
Tomato, they need a lot of water and plant feed, tomato plants. Yeah, they're quite the guzzlers. Yeah.
Rocket somewhere in the comments says, what have you done with Martin? And I just want to clear this up because you've replied to the chat in text, Robin, saying he's in a better place. And I just want to emphasize he's not in a better place. He's in prison. And hence why we want to talk about prison escapes in this episode.
Exactly. Ooh, nice segue. I like that.
Well, actually, do you know what? I've segued to that. But first, I do want to address comments of the week.
Ooh.
Do you have an interesting comment that you'd like to raise from the past week or in the live chat?
Yeah, I've got a couple, actually. From our last podcast, which was about Room 101 in George Orwell's 1984, his novel, 1984. The couple of short ones, if you don't mind, I'll read them both out. Alan Haff. Okay, fine.
Choose your favorite and stick to that. No, it's fine. That's more the merrier.
Alan Haff said, I read the book 1984 at school in the 1970s, and I thought it was a fantasy, which I thought was interesting. As in, I mean, genuine question.
Oh, do you mean naive fantasy summer child?
Yeah, exactly. Do you mean fantasy in the genre? Because if you do, then I hope you recognise that it's not fantasy now. It's science fiction. Or do you mean that in the ha ha? I thought this could never happen. And of course, yes. How naive!
I think like when you're in school, I remember reading it and being quite confused by it. I think just the naming conventions and things, like all the different departments and ministries. It did seem quite. I can see where they're coming from. It seems like fantasy names almost.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, I don't know, it depends when you read it in school, I guess, whether you would catch on to a lot of the themes in that book. I don't know. Interesting. What was your second comment, Robin, or did you want me to go?
No, I'm happy to go now. Yeah, it was by Tracy Tron on the same video, saying, I presume, having not watched the video, commented, this is about cancel culture, isn't it? Yeah, no, pee off. That's called the consequences of your actions.
I'm so sorry, so Robin. What podcast did you say this was from, or video?
This was from our video about George Orwell's 1984.
Oh, it was. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right, interesting. And
yeah, exactly. I wanted to bring that up because I've thank you, Tracy Tron, for commenting. But please elaborate on that comment, either by replying to that comment on the video or by telling us in response to this video. What did you mean by that? Because I don't think we ever mentioned cancel culture. And
I mean, in fairness to Tracy, I did want to cancel a lot of things in that episode. I wanted to cancel a lot of things and add them to my personal Room 101.
That's true. The things you're putting into Room 101 was very much the world, yeah.
Well, no, just most of it. Yeah, sure. But I do agree with that. I mean, I kind of do agree with that in principle. Do we want to get into that now? That feels like it's a whole other thing.
But it could be a thorny.
Robin, cancel culture. Summarize it in one sentence. Go for it.
Sometimes it's earned, sometimes it isn't.
But you think it exists?
Oh, you mean, I see. Now I see what you mean. I don't know.
Dead air.
It's a tough one. It definitely, some people have done stuff that, yeah, consequences of your actions. Yeah, if you do something, you deserve to be, what's the word? Ostracized and called out. And that's not the same as that got labeled as cancel culture, I believe, by the people who knew that they could get cancelled because they shared those very unpleasant views. However, there is also still something of a bandwagon, I guess. I don't know if you feel this way. Sometimes people say things on social media and there's a very strong response and you're just like, hold on a second, everyone in the world, pause and read what this person said and look at the words. They're not actually saying what you think they're saying.
Sounds like you're about to defend Kanye West, Robin.
No, no. I don't really understand. Let's cancel it.
The stream's ending. We cancel.
Yeah. I'm privileged and lucky enough to be on the side of cancel culture that perpetrates it, I guess. As in, I'm very much the whole like, yes, I don't want to hear from Donald Trump. I don't want to hear from Kanye West. Mm. I don't want to hear from... although now they're all back on Twitter, aren't they? Everyone's back now. And some people, you're just like, yeah, please get cancelled.
I'm going to move on, Robin, but this was enlightening. And
you asked a very tricky question.
Yeah, I did, and I'm very sorry. I think many
you set up a trap, and I fell straight into it.
I think many people would agree with what you're saying, though. Kat Hales in the chat says, cancel culture doesn't exist, it's just consequences. And I think you're kind of maybe saying a bit of that, but also like there's bandwagoning on social media and you lose a bit of nuance. There's two sides to every story and maybe you lose that kind of nuance in social media aspect. Is that, I hate to put words in your mouth, but is that?
No, thank you. That was a very good summary. The only thing I would remove from that summary of what I said was two sides to every story, that there isn't. Sometimes people just say racist things.
Well, and
there's no side to that. Yeah.
But if you would like to follow us on Twitter while it's still active anyway, feel free. I'm at just Alexing.
I'm at all time Robin.
And if you would like to follow Martin when his account is back online, I believe it is Martin Tresting.
At Martin. Yeah, Martin Tresting. Yeah. Or you can follow the channel at JInterestingYT.
Yeah. I do wonder, I mean, it's kind of all died down recently, the whole Twitter like being shut down. But maybe our handles will be updated to something more relevant in the future. I might just put like, I don't know. I don't know what I'd put, to be honest. I don't really do socials apart from those two. There are a few others that were mentioned. I know people were talking about Mastodon, but it seems incredibly complicated.
Yeah. I contemplated joining Mastodon when there was the Great Exodus, but I never heard of it before. And then it's a weird way to build a social network, isn't it? Let's make people pick their specialist server. Yeah, like this is your board game server. This is your video game server. You have to pick the one you want to join. I'm like, wow, way to pigeonhole people.
Yeah, it is. It's very strange. Interesting.
Yeah. And the other one, Hive. I think I've heard of Hive, but I don't know at all about how that works.
Yeah, I've heard that's quite a good one actually. So that could be. Could be a successor. Who knows? We'll look into it. But Robin, I did think what yours could be, if you did want to change your tag. You're too nice to say it, but I want to say it for you. Could be Mr. Robin Reads himself. Robin Reads audiobooks, is it, on YouTube?
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
If anyone is not aware, you can listen to Robin's dulcet tones reading you bedtime stories for free on YouTube at Robin Reads audiobooks.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go and subscribe.
I've done a Christmas carol. If anyone wants to listen to a Christmas carol, it's seasonal.
Well, you've recently done Lovecraft, H.P. Lovecraft, I saw.
Yeah, possibly my favorite H.P. Lovecraft story, actually. I'd start on a high. The Hound. Mm. It's a nice and short little scary story. I love H.P. Lovecraft, do you?
Do you know what? I'm ashamed to say I've never actually sat down and read any of H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh.
But what I do love is Bloodborne, which is heavily inspired by H.P. Lovecraft.
It is, actually, yeah. Yeah. That's the thing, H.P. Lovecraft, he's so unique in his influence that it's so hard to avoid the Lovecraftian touch. Mm. A bit like the way, I guess, Monty Python humor, Python-esque humor, is pervasive these days. You just kind of, it's fascinating. He's so influential. It's wonderful. So,
yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. He had some problematic views, didn't he, even in his day?
He did. Now, that's an interesting example. Speaking of cancel culture, that's an example of where H.P. Lovecraft had some deeply problematic views on race. Mm. And yet you can still enjoy his stories. And I think that's an instance where if you detect racism in his stories, that's a personal choice you have to make as a reader about whether to educate people or ignore him. But that doesn't mean you should stop everyone else from reading H.P. Lovecraft.
Because isn't Lovecraftian horror very much the fear of the other? Like, what's behind the curtain? And isn't that kind of, you can see...
Yes, there is absolutely a strong xenophobic current. But then isn't that the same with all horror?
Well, I mean, it's always...
All monsters.
It's always difficult, you know, to separate the art from the artist. I think that's a more difficult
journey to take.
I mean, it's difficult going back and watching anything with Kevin Spacey in these days.
Yeah, and not see it. Yeah. Michael Jackson. You still love Michael Jackson's music, don't you, Alex?
I never did, to be honest. Controversial, I know.
Oh, yeah, sure. I didn't like Michael Jackson before everyone thought he was a paedophile. Yeah.
It just wasn't for me. It's fine, though. It's fine, but it just wasn't for me. Yeah. Anyway, Robin, I think we've gone on to... Well, you always do this when it's a duo. We get into serious discussions. But the moral of that story was basically go and subscribe to Robin Reed's audiobooks.
Thank you.
And yeah, you get to listen to his dulcet tones for free. So go and do that. But Robin, I think it's about time that we get on to the main discussion this week, which of course is Alcatraz. Okay, so a little bit of background. Alcatraz Penitentiary is a fortress in San Francisco Bay. It housed notorious criminals as well as known escape artists. This prison was by far the most expensive to operate in US history. Prisoners had their own cells, and there was roughly one guard to every three prisoners. It also had a natural defense, obviously, being in San Francisco Bay, of a mile of turbulent water surrounding the island. This separated it from the mainland. If a prisoner did manage to escape their cell, they would still have no way off the island. The prison was in operation from 1934 to 1963, during which time 36 prisoners made 14 escape attempts. Of these 36 prisoners, Robin, 23 were captured, 6 were shot and killed, 4 drowned in the bay, and only 3 were ever considered to possibly be successful in one of the most intricate and daring prison escapes ever recorded. Frank Morris and brothers John and Clarence Anglin broke out of their cells on the 11th of June, 1961, and in a makeshift raft, left Alcatraz Island. They were never seen again. Did they perish in their daring escape attempt, or was it possible that they succeeded in the greatest prison break in history? That is what we are here to discuss. So I think the first thing to talk about when discussing Alcatraz, or this prison break in particular, is when we're deciding whether they got away, which ultimately is the enduring mystery. Did these people manage to escape? First, you've got to look at the men themselves. Did they have the chops to pull this off? And this is, in my opinion, the first evidence to suggest that maybe they did.
Cool.
So looking at the men themselves, first of all, this prison was in operation for 29 years, and it had some of the most dangerous criminals in the US at the time. It housed Al Capone, George Machine Gun Kelly, a man called Alvin Creepy Carpus, which is an amazing nickname to have. Imagine that. Oh my God, Alvin Carpus. So creepy. That's his nickname.
Just call him Creepy.
Creepy. Yeah. He was one of only 6 people in history to be officially named public enemy number 1.
Really?
But as well as housing these extremely dangerous criminals, this prison also housed prisoners with a history of making daring escapes. And so these men, Frank Morris, had been in and out of jail since he was a teenager from crimes ranging from narcotic possession to armed robbery, and he had previously escaped from Louisiana State Penitentiary. So he's already got prison breaks on his resume. You know, he's already done this before.
That helps, yeah.
Also, he ranked in the top 2% of Americans in intelligence with an IQ of 133. He's a smart cookie. He's a smart man. And when he was stationed at Alcatraz, his cell was in close proximity to John and Clarence Anglin, who he had known from previous stays in prison and who had also tried, although unsuccessfully, to break out of Atlanta prison. So, you know, that seems like a smart idea, doesn't it? Let's house all the people.
It doesn't seem like the smartest thing to do, yeah.
Let's house all the people that have broken out of prisons or tried to in like the same block of cells. That sounds like a good idea, doesn't
it? Had they not heard of the Great Escape from World War II? Come on. The movie came out in 1963.
Well, no, that's after this time then. So no, they hadn't seen The Great Escape, Robin.
They didn't know.
But yes, so in December 1961, these men, along with a man called Alan West, who was also in a cell block close to them, began planning an escape. Mm-hmm. So phase one of their plan, as you may imagine, was simply getting out of their cell. You can't escape from prison if you're still stuck in your cell, Roman. That's just, you know,
makes physics. Sense. Yeah.
So their focus was drawn to the air vents on the wall in each prisoner's cell. They used discarded saw blades and cutlery from the canteen to chip away at the walls surrounding their air vent cover to widen the gap. So imagine an air vent on the wall with a cover over it. They used whatever they could find to gradually make this wall outline a little bit larger so they could remove the air vent and escape through to a maintenance corridor. And this is what they did. They even managed to make a rudimentary power drill to help with this process using a discarded vacuum engine, which is amazing.
What?
Amazingly ingenious, you would say.
Yeah. I'm genuinely fascinated that the guards didn't notice them. They must have smuggled these things into their cells, right?
It's interesting how many kind of workshops they had in this prison. They had like clothes making, shoes making, repair workshops. They put the prisoners to work basically, and I think it was in those operations, you know, when prisoners were vacuuming and stuff, they were able to acquire these materials. But it's interesting to know, how did they get away with this? This must have caused quite a lot of commotion. And the answer to that is that they did all of this whilst the prison was having... They did all of this during the prison's music hour. And Frank Morris played his accordion to drown out their noise. This prison.
Oh, wonderful.
This prison
wonderful.
Sounds lovely, Robin. They've got music hour. They've got workshops you can attend. It sounds lovely.
They've got vacuum cleaners.
They've all got their own cell.
They put you with your friends who you tried to escape
put you with
before.
Your friends. Well, John and Clarence were brothers, and they didn't think to separate them. They were like, there, you can be next to each other. That's fine.
Yeah, brothers hate each other. They'll never work together.
So they managed to do this over several months and made it to the maintenance corridor. But this was just the first step of the plan. Once they removed the air vent cover, they could leave their cells and access this rarely used maintenance corridor, which led them to a vacant top level of their cell block, which is where phase two would begin. You see, Robin, escaping Alcatraz prison is actually kind of the easy part.
Oh.
Making it to the mainland of the island without drowning in the fast-flowing currents of the bay, that is the real challenge. And that is what they had to overcome. And this is where they did it. So over the next 6 months, the men gradually constructed a 6x14-foot rubber raft made out of more than 50 prison raincoats that the men had stolen or just, you know, collected from the other prisoners. So again, a huge amount of materials that they've been able to, like, steal or collect. Without the guards must have been like, where's everyone's coats disappearing to?
Yeah. I mean, firstly, I'm impressed that the prisoners got raincoats because I'd have thought... I'm intrigued, rather, because I'd have thought in bad weather, just put the prisoners inside. Why are the prisoners outside in bad weather? You know, it's kind of interesting. I guess they have to have their day, their exercise, regardless of the weather, and that's why they got the raincoats? I don't know. But also, do you say 40 raincoats? They managed to...
Over 50. Over 50 raincoats.
Wow. And you couldn't do that today, could you? Because those back then, the raincoats were made of rubber, weren't they? So they're really proper.
Yeah. And what was
they would float and they would be waterproof. Today's raincoats made of,
yeah,
I don't know what they're made of, like nylon, stuff like that. They wouldn't be nearly as effective.
Yeah, I guess not. But you may be wondering how they knew how to make this, because they didn't just stitch them together. This had to be airtight.
So, that's a good point. Yes, yes.
So they, it was actually the in this amazing 5-star luxury prison, they also had a library with books. But the guards made sure to censor these books for with any information that could be useful to getting to having a getaway.
But may I interject?
Sure.
That's the first sensible thing it sounds like this prison did. The first thing you've mentioned that sounds sensible.
What, censor some books?
Censoring the books from stuff that could be useful to the prisoners. So far, it's been like, we'll give them all these tools, give them access, we'll give them bloody raincoats, we'll put all the friends next to each other,
it's like
put
they
the
were
escapists
begging
next to each
them.
Other.
It's like they were begging for one of them to succeed, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
But, I mean, as C.S. Drummerson just pointed out in the comments, why would the officers be so worried about them? Alcatraz was inescapable. Who cares if some missing coats and tools escape? You know, it's not like anyone is going to escape. And, yeah, I mean, that's probably what the guards were thinking at the time. Like, they can almost be, you know, take it easy. No one's going to escape the prison. You know, how are they going to get away? Yeah, of course. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, no, it was in a magazine that they found in the library that the guards had missed because they didn't think this would have any kind of relevance, but it involved a section on vulcanizing rubber. And that's how they learned how to vulcanize rubber to make this vacuum tight seal. Heat. So it's very smart.
Yeah. That raises interesting questions about censorship, doesn't it? About
the effectiveness?
Yeah, the slippery slope argument, I mean. Yes, the effectiveness of censorship, since there was knowledge they were able to use regardless because they had the imagination, but also the whole kind of, if you're censoring something with a particular purpose in mind, in this case, useful information for people wanting to escape, clearly they didn't censor everything that was useful to people trying to escape. So when do you stop, you know? When, at what point, as a prison guard, as the warden, do you say, actually, let's just not have a library. Let's go full 1984 Big Brother. Let's have no radio, no TVs, no books, nothing. They just stay in their cells and we'll, you know, monitor them and play on the speaker system mantras, brainwashing mantras all day long just to stop them having any kind of imaginative thought that might lead them to escape.
Mm. Yeah,
also, let's put maintenance walkway right behind the cells.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think, though, that there was something in what some of the comments are saying. Like, I feel like the guards were kind of... No one expected anyone to escape, so why would they be that strict on these prisoners, you know? But I do wonder if attitudes have changed somewhat in the prison system in the US over the last 40, 50, 60 years. But who knows? Who knows? But anyway, back to the story.
Yes, sorry to interrupt.
No problem. Over the next 5-6 months, they put together this 6x14-foot rubber raft made out of more than 50 prison raincoats, some wooden paddles, life preservers. They made life jackets for themselves, as well as four makeshift imitation heads made out of concrete dust, soap, toothpaste, and toilet paper. And the intention behind these makeshift heads, obviously, was to hopefully fool any patrolling guards peering into their cells on the night of the escape. They would see these heads propped up in bed, and hopefully they would be just realistic enough to fool the guards into thinking they were fast asleep.
Mm.
So
why did they hide them? How did they do prison? Don't they do cell searches? Isn't that a thing they do?
But Robin, they had access to their own personal workshop. So in the dead of night, they would leave their cells into this maintenance corridor. Then they would go to this vacant area that would lead to the top part of their cell block that was vacant.
Yeah.
It was a whole workshop that they had set up building this raft and things for 6 months.
Wow.
No one checked on them. amazing.
Absolutely incredible.
And then after they'd built all of these things, phase two was complete. The only thing left to do was to carry out the plan. So on the 11th of June, 1961, John, Clarence, and Frank all left their cells via the air vent while, you know, positioning their makeshift heads. Unfortunately, Alan couldn't remove the vent from his cell in time. The kind of gap that he'd made, or this fake area of wall that they'd all put up, so when the guards did check their cells, it didn't look like the air vent had, they'd ripped it off the wall. They'd made like a makeshift wall part. Is that making sense?
I think so. Yeah, like a dummy wall.
Yeah, on Alan's one that was slipping, so he'd reinforced it with concrete. But unfortunately, what that meant was he couldn't actually get out of his cell. He remade the cell wall, and he made it too strong.
Oops.
Basically.
Well,
and they when they were outside in the maintenance corridor, they were actually kicking at his vent. They were trying their best to help him, but sadly they couldn't get it. They couldn't get it off, and they had to leave him behind.
That's actually kind of nice to hear that they did try to get him out. That feels, you know, the classic image of prisoners is, you know, no honor amongst thieves kind of thing.
Yeah, they tried.
If you fall behind, you're left behind.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they did leave him behind, but at least they tried.
Eventually they did. He did actually make it out of his cell. But by that time it was too late and the men had already left. So they used a ventilation shaft from this maintenance corridor, which led them to the roof of the prison. Once on the roof, they shimmied down a pipe, evaded guard patrols, climbed over two barbed wire fences, and gradually made their way to the northwest of the island, which was the least kind of well-guarded part of the island. Yeah. And from here, they inflated their raft, put on their life preservers, and set off into the night. And unfortunately, Robin, this is where the story moves into speculation territory.
Oh.
Because obviously they were never seen again. There was some evidence that cropped up from this, but we don't know what happened to the men ultimately. But according to Alan West, who remained behind, they were attempting to reach the closest landmass to Alcatraz Island, which is called Angel Island, which is just to the north of San Francisco Bay, I think. From here, they intended to burglarize a clothes store and go their separate ways. However, no burglaries were reported in this area after the escape took place, leading many people to believe that they must have perished in the rough waters of San Francisco Bay. I'm sure you're familiar with this from the last time we spoke about this, Robin, but there are very strong currents in San Francisco Bay that all lead out to the ocean. It's a really interesting type of current stream that goes into San Francisco Bay. The waters kind of all, with tremendous amounts of force, kind of evacuate the bay out into the ocean, and then it all comes back eventually. But it's not easy to go against the currents, basically. And Mythbusters, the TV show, they attempted to get to Angel Island, or tried to see if it would be possible to get to Angel Island in their own makeshift raft. And they couldn't get to Angel Island, but they did get to Horseshoe Bay, which is downstream, basically, from Angel Island. But if they'd rowed directly north, then the current would have led them to Horseshoe Bay, which is just like right before you go through the Golden Gate Bridge, basically. On the north side, I think. And so it was possible to get to land. The Mythbusters did prove that. But interestingly, a few days after this, when it was discovered that they were missing, patrols did find a life vest, a paddle, a wallet from one of the men, and the remains of the raft were recovered from different areas of the bay, but no bodies were ever discovered. So it's unknown what happened to the men. What's your personal thoughts?
I think I feel a similar way about this as I do about D.B. Cooper, you know. I really want, despite their crimes, I really want them to have succeeded. I really want them to have got away with it. I really want the lack of evidence of their bodies to be proof that they got away with it. But deep down, somewhere in my heart,
you just
I have a feeling they didn't quite make that final step. And Mother Nature, in the case of D.B. Cooper, the storm and the rocks below, and in this case, the power of the sea, took them with them.
Well, that is very upsetting to hear, Robin. That's I'm how sorry, you think. Alex. But there is some more evidence that could possibly lead to a mystery solved of this mystery.
Okay, yeah.
Or at least some more kind of interesting things to consider. So first of all, this plan that they would get to Angel Island is what Alan West told police when they interrogated him. And they seemed to be, they were friends, right? They tried to get Alan West out.
Would he have told them the truth?
I could very much see Alan West lying to the authorities and giving them a false lead so that they were investigating Angel Island when actually they managed some kind of different escape plan.
That's true, yeah.
Also, on the night in question, a mysterious white boat was spotted in the bay that was unidentified. So maybe some people think that they'd arranged for an outside source to come and pick them up.
I mean, that would make sense if you could get that information out. And from the sound of things, in Alcatraz, you could do anything. Maybe they could communicate sufficiently with the outside world to arrange a pickup.
Arrange a pickup on a specific day in question.
We should also explain their hurry, right? Because, I mean, on the night that you're going to escape, you want to do it. You don't really want to go back into your cells and say, okay, we'll do it tomorrow, lads. But they left the other guy behind, you know? And I feel like if there weren't a sense of urgency, maybe the sense of urgency was that they had arranged a pickup for that night and they're like, it's now or never.
Yeah.
You know?
Spiffing in the chat says, an off-duty cop saw a white boat around 10 p.m. in the water from Marina Green. And is that the men actually on their way out of the prison were making a big ruckus. And apparently a guard heard at around 10:30 p.m. a massive loud bang on the roof. And he must have just been, it's just the wind. But actually it's thought that this is them opening the kind of grate to the roof. They made a massive loud noise.
Just imagine that. You're them. You're trying to be careful. And then you just make this smashing noise and you just...
Yeah.
And then nothing? Okay, that's good.
6 months, 6 months nearly down the drain just because you made a loud bang.
Yeah. Because you got that guard from the movies. That guy is like, does that over the shoulder kind of, what was that?
Yeah.
Nothing. And then walks on. Oh my gosh. Sorry, I know we've presented a very limited scope, but this story does sound like Alcatraz is not not a great.
Well, I mean, it was like they were dying for one of them to finally actually escape. The guards were willing them on almost. What do you need? Do you want a speedboat? We can get you a speedboat. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, the warden's like telling all the guards that. Now remember, leave the keys to the ignition of the speedboat in. In the speedboat.
Sign up to fundamentals.
Fully fueled.
Yeah, we offer tons of classes. Here's lock picking 101. Fundamentals of swimming. How to make a great disguise. Yeah.
And today is papier-mâché heads.
But as the Mythbusters said in their episode when they were concluding it, they did manage to make it to land. But they said the most compelling reason the men didn't escape from the prison is that you would have assumed that there would have been sightings of them since then. Right?
Yeah.
You would have assumed that how could they just drop off the radar? They would have been sighted at some point.
Maybe it's different now, but I personally wouldn't know a criminal who escaped from prison if I saw them in the street.
True, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what have anyway, I told sorry. You that there could have been sightings, though, Robin?
Oh, my gosh. The plot thickens.
So the nephews of John and Clarence Anglin still believe that they survived the ordeal and escaped to Brazil. And in 2016, they presented a photo to the FBI, allegedly taken in 1975, showing the two brothers working on a farm in Brazil. And they claimed the photo was taken by a family friend called Fred Brizzy, who was a man known for his connections to the criminal underworld. He was a drug smuggler. He could have been the person that collected them from the bay in this mysterious white boat, possibly, and took them down to Brazil. And interestingly, a forensic expert who compared the faces to their mugshots said that they were very likely the same men, which pretty compelling. And in addition to the photographs, the nephews also claimed that the mother of the two brothers received Christmas cards with their signatures for three consecutive years after the escape. So that's also pretty interesting.
Well, there are two possibilities with that one, Alex. Yep. Either they did escape and they sent Christmas cards, or before the night of the escape, they arranged... They did a Doc Brown in Back to the Future, like three Christmas cards, not to be delivered until Christmas 63, 64, 65.
And using the amazing facilities, postal facilities at the prison,
yes,
they were able to future date those, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Was that the only communication anyone had from them, just those Christmas cards?
I believe so, and they would send flowers on their mother's birthday, apparently, according to these nephews. But what's interesting is that the cards apparently just said, like, from John thing. They didn't have anything kind of personal information in there. It said, to mother from John, Merry Christmas. Don't know.
Yeah.
You'd think that they would include a more personal message or something that only they would know. So that she would know for sure that it was definitely them, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Unless they relied solely on her recognizing their handwriting.
That's possible as well.
It's an interesting one. I don't know if I would have the ability to resist writing something more personal in that situation. It's a weird, like, because if you're committed to laying low and stopping the authorities from tracing you down, the fact that you've taken the step to send a Christmas card to your relatives, you're kind of like, you're already breaking that commitment to laying low. So you might as well go a bit further.
Yeah, right. Exactly. If you're going to do it, you may as well go the whole way. Also, interestingly, when their mother died, apparently two unrecognized abnormally large women who were unusually dressed were apparently spotted at her funeral and stayed for the service, but then left very promptly, leading some to suspect that the men came and cross-dressed at their mother's funeral. I'm not sure if I buy into that necessarily, and there's very limited evidence for that claim, to be fair. There is also recent evidence from 2015 that was quite compelling, I thought. So in 2015, a declassified FBI file showed that they received a letter from someone claiming to be John Anglin. And this letter from John claimed that they all escaped the prison that night and had lived in Seattle for most of it. He had lived in Seattle for most of his life and spent eight years in North Dakota. At the time the letter was sent, he was reportedly living in Southern California. However, John claimed that Morris had died in 2005 and his brother Clarence in 2008. He wrote that he had cancer and was in a bad way. He even offered to turn himself in if he was guaranteed to only serve 1 year in jail, but authorities had to go on TV and announce that to the public, that he would only serve 1 year in jail, and he would turn himself in if he could receive medical attention. Now, the FBI analyzed the letter for DNA and fingerprints, but found their results were inconclusive, but they apparently didn't hear from John again, and they never told the family they received this letter until it was publicly released in 2015. And they'd sat on it for like 5 years, I think. So the family were very annoyed at the FBI because they felt bad. You know, they thought one of our family members is old, alone, asking for medical help. And no one knows what happened to him.
It's not very humane, is it, to do that? It's not very nice, even if they're a criminal.
Mm. Yeah. But the FBI just said that they thought it was a hoax and they didn't buy it for 1 second, basically. They thought it was just an attempt to embarrass authorities to make them go on TV and say, you know, yeah,
right.
John, come out of hiding. We won't prosecute you. But I do feel like the case of DB Cooper, past a certain point, I feel like authorities, I know it's a bad principle to say, but in exceptional circumstances, should just say, okay, fair play, you got us. Come out, and you're not going to get prosecuted. We actually want to congratulate you and say you won, and find out how you did it to learn from next time. You know,
That last point is very useful. Sometimes, I mean, they do sometimes, like hackers. Obviously, a lot of them go straight and become cybersecurity experts. So the same would be there for people who've successfully escaped from prison. Make them security consultants for prisons. Yeah,
famously. At Frank Abagnale, Catch Me If You Can, did that.
Of course,
But yeah, that seems to be all the evidence so far that I could find anyway. Let me know in the comments or if you're listening to this later on, find us on Twitter if there's any other evidence that I missed. But I don't know, Robin. I like to think that they did get away. I do like to think that they got away. I don't know if I'm fully believe it, but do you know what? Why not? Why not?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a romantic at heart, a bit of an optimist at heart. So, yeah, the fact that there's no conclusive proof that they didn't make it, I'd like to think they made it too.
And also, they found a lot of their items left behind that were scattered all across the bay just because of the way the tides there work. But like a paddle, the boat, the wallet, but they never found any bodies. They never found any bodies, and I do find that interesting.
Yeah, me too.
They never washed up. Given that they had life preservers on. So presumably that's the thing as well,
they should float, and you only sink, I believe, if you drown, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they had the life preservers on, so they could have survived. They could have made it.
Yeah, I like to think that they made it. But at the end of the day, though, Robin, I think we've got to say that it's extremely unlikely we'll ever find out what happened.
At this point in history, it's been 60 years, hasn't it?
60 years almost, yeah. No, over 60 years. 61 years?
Yeah.
Yes, right? If Martin was here, he would know. He's good at maths. He's good at the numbers.
We'll have to ask.
But I do hope that this has inspired Martin to make a prison break of his own, and hopefully he'll be with us next week.
If you found yourself in the situation in Alcatraz, Alex, or the modern equivalent, do you think you'd have the wherewithal to escape?
How long am I in prison for?
Oh, it's just like a serious, 10-20 year sentence.
Honestly, if the prison is as nice as Alcatraz sounds, no, I'd stay there for indefinitely. Sounds delightful. I take some pottery classes, electrical engineering PhD apparently, or do something cool. I'd be loving that music hour. Sounds like a great time.
Yeah, I'd love to learn the accordion, and you'd have loads of time.
But sadly, Robin, as it is just the two of us this week, we unfortunately don't have a quiz. But what I can do is tell you the answer to the amazing riddle that I gave you earlier. Would you like to hear it again?
I would.
Do you have an answer for me, by the way, Robin?
I might do.
Okay.
But I don't like it.
So I'll read it again. If 11 plus 2 equals 1, what does 9 plus 5 equal?
Okay.
Do you have an answer?
So 11 plus 2 is 13, and 9 plus 5 is 14. Mm. 14 comes after 13. So if 13 is 1, is 14 is the answer to.
So, Robin, you have done a remarkable thing, which is you've got the answer right. But you know, you know when you've done in maths in school, when you have to show you're working, and once in a blue moon, you get the answer right, but you've done it in the wrong way, and you've completely got the kind of, the thesis is completely wrong, but somehow you've got the answer right. So yes,
okay.
So yes, it is two. But the answer is because it's a clock face. So 11 plus 2 is 1 o'clock. 9 o'clock plus 5 is 2 o'clock. As C.S. Drummerson says in the comments, task failed successfully. but yes, that was the riddle this week. Well done, Robin. And well done to
so
a few.
A clock
I think
face,
a few people yeah. did get that in the comments. I don't know if they did the same reasoning that you did, though, Robin, or if they got that it was meant to be a clock face. But yeah, that was the riddle this week.
So. I would never have guessed the clock thing. See, if the numbers were different, maybe I would have. Does that work for every single?
I don't know.
Do they
Robin.
All add up that way? I'm now very intrigued. Have to work this out. But also, that, Alex, that's. See, this is what's sort of ridiculous about these types of riddles. You know, I got the methodology completely wrong.
You still got,
still
right.
got the right answer.
You can expect way more of these from me, Robin.
Keep them coming. Keep them coming. You'll convert me yet, one day.
But I do want to say thank you, everyone in the YouTube comments, for watching this and listening to us live. Thank you so much. If you enjoyed this video and you're listening to or podcast and you're listening to us at a later date and the podcast platform offers some kind of review process, feel free to rate us 5 stars if you want. That would be lovely.
Yeah, it'd be great. Yeah.
And if there's a way to, you know, add a comment to that review, then feel free to do that as well. And we may read it out in a future episode. And once again, we go live every week at 9 p.m. BST over on YouTube at Just Interesting. So feel free to go over and subscribe to us there so you don't miss us when we go live. Thank you, everyone, so much for tuning in and watching us. Is there anything else you want to add, Robin?
Just, yeah, huge thank you to everybody who's listening to us at any point in time. And, of course, especially to our Patreon supporters and YouTube members. Anyone joining the YouTube channel and supporting us on Patreon, you're amazing. Thank you so much.
Indeed. Thank you, everyone, so much for watching. And thank you again to our Patreon supporters and YouTube members. You guys are the best. And we will see you guys next time.
Ciao for now.